Jackson Levine, LAVINE. My current address is 4978 Sentinel Drive, Sentinel Drive, apartment 406, Bethesda, Maryland, 20816. My telephone number is area code 301-229-6640. I started at the University of Wisconsin in September 1941. I graduated in May or June 1945. I was an undergraduate there. I graduated from Julia Richman High School, RICHMAN High School, in New York City. It was a school of 8,000 all girls in the heart of Manhattan, and I graduated in a class of about 800 girls. I was, I think, something like 50 or 60th in that class. I was in a sort of an honor school part of the high school. I was only 16 and 1 month when I graduated from high school, and that was in January of 1945. I therefore didn't want to go to school until September. I had applied to the University of Michigan, which was my first choice. I also applied, as I recall, to Penn State College. Was not accepted at Michigan, and at that point I decided to go to the University of Wisconsin. My sister had just graduated from the University of Wisconsin in June of 1945. She had selected the university because my father, who had died when I was only 10 years old, was a doctor, had always talked about the university and the liberal tradition of the La Follettes and John R. Commons, the social welfare programs that had been pioneered there. And she had heard so much about this, and she was interested in labor economics. And she went to the university and majored in labor economics, studying under Selig Perlman, and later got her master's at Columbia in economics. As far as universities, comparison to schools like Beloit, the University of Chicago, or Minnesota, or Harvard, these were never schools that ever came to mind to me. I never had heard of Beloit until a nephew of mine went there about 10 years ago. The University of Chicago, Minnesota, and Harvard were completely, they were never in my mind. The only possibility for me was something in the East Coast, but I wanted a co-ed school, and I wanted a school away from New York. And it amazes me today when I look at when my children were 17, think that my mother, a widow with three daughters, could then have thought of me traipsing off to the wilds of Madison. I went to Wisconsin in a train with two other girls who were going for the first time. We sent a trunk, a steam, no, I guess it was a steamer trunk, a wardrobe trunk. We had sent out ahead by Railway Express. I did not have any automobile, did not have any phonograph. I don't even think I had any books. I did have two formals. One was a bright red sleeve straps, very thin straps, and one was a black taffeta shirtwaist, very formal looking, almost matronly looking. I had a mouton coat. It was kind of short and a little chubby, and I probably looked like a little bear in it. I had a lot of skirts and sweaters and saddle shoes and socks. I think later out there I bought stadium boots. I also had a Paris tweed reversible coat, I remember. And I guess one or two, couple of dressy dresses. I don't remember too many of them. The two other girls and I took the train to Chicago, and then we got on a bus to take a look at Lakeshore Drive, and then we took the Milwaukee Road to Milwaukee. Nobody greeted us. I suppose we took a taxi to where we were going to be living. I don't remember anything about that. As far as choosing my courses, my first semester I was going to major in journalism. And I had Frank Thayer, as I recall, as my advisor. I took one or two courses in journalism, a couple of courses in political science and English, things like that. I don't remember any student orientation session. I do remember taking an English test that eventually exempted me from taking any kind of any taking the freshman English. I later took a course on French, which exempted me from any more foreign languages because the French I passed. After my first semester, I decided that what I was learning in journalism, I had known by experience on my high school paper, and I was learning it from the Cardinal, and I couldn't see the value of book learning in journalism. I therefore dropped journalism, and I think I first went into, I'm not sure, political science. I eventually ended up in an American institutions major, which was a fairly new kind of interdisciplinary major where you could take any three subjects of, as I recall, it was history, political science, philosophy, sociology, maybe psychology, I don't know what else. Anyway, I concentrated in history, political science, and sociology at that point. I mean, economics also. I think I had Selig Perlman as an advisor at one point, and I also had, I don't know, it was Merle Curdy. I don't even remember who my advisor was. Obviously, he didn't spend much time with me, and he probably was not very helpful. One of the things I had against Wisconsin, that I never really got to know any professors in classes too well. Dorothy Thompson was my ambition to be a foreign correspondent, and I therefore was taking primarily history and political science courses. As far as what we, I don't think I made any specific point at which I made that decision. I just decided that American institutions would give me a broad enough background and allow me to take the courses in international relations that I wanted to, because there was no, as I don't recall, a general major in international relations at the time. As well as I can remember, students wore sweaters and skirts and saddle shoes and bobby socks for class. Professors pretty much wore suits. The only attire that stands out is Helen White, who always wore purple dresses. That's the only one I can remember. The only other one I remember is Frederick Ogg, who would sit in his suit, double with his vest and his Phi Beta Kappa keys sitting very prominently on his stomach. Most of the classes were lecture classes. There were very few small seminars or discussions. Students did not really participate that much in class. They certainly behaved, kept fairly quiet. I can't remember professors handling any discipline. I don't remember any discipline problems. Classes were mostly co-ed, except, of course, when there weren't that many males on campus. But even then, we had some of the Army students, I think. I seem to recall them in classes. And there were still a number of other boys on campus. There was some, I guess, 4Fs, but I don't remember. The classes were still fairly co-ed. Maybe it was just, to me, having gone to school for so many years, all girls, just having any men in the class made it seem unusual to me. Because there were so many women, I think women were treated the same in terms of expectations and access to materials. The average lecture was probably about 100 people, I can think. I think the largest I can remember were probably Kiefhofer's lecture, giving this cheer at the beginning of the class. We used to have graduate students give us quiz sessions. Didn't have any lab classes because I did not take science. I took math. I got out of science after about 2 days, didn't like it, and got math. So I didn't have any lab classes. I did have quiz classes, quiz sessions. Classes were usually quite formal. Even in a more or less seminar section, there was no real discussion that I can remember. We carried notebooks to class. We carried books to class. I don't remember actually taking that much in the way of textbooks. The majority of the professors gave it through lecture. I can't give you specific examples of these. I'm afraid this is just too far back. In non-lecture situations, students were expected to participate in class to discuss things, but I don't really remember that much of a broad participation. I think we called all professors doctor or professor. I think they called us primarily by Mr. and Miss, I think. I really don't remember that. I don't know anyone who's ever been caught as a truant. There was a famous situation, I think it was my freshman year, with Scott Goodnight catching, no, it wasn't really a truant, though. That was just sort of caught on some porch at the fraternity house. Course expectations, how are they generally communicated to students? I don't remember that. There was a lot of memorization of dates, of events, especially in history. Someone like Frederick Ogg was one of the most notable examples of this, where he would sit there lecturing to us about something that happened in Japan, and he would say, for example, now on February 5th, 1898, this and such happened, and then he'd stop and say, no, February 6th. This is something I always remember. It's such a stickler, that kind of thing. I seem to recall classes being either Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday and Thursday for about an hour. I don't know whether that's correct or not. There, number 30, how much homework? I can't remember anything about that. I do remember about papers. I just don't remember as much about homework. Number 31, I assume you mean how accessible were your professors, not how accessible. They had office hours. I very rarely went to see them because I was so busy with the Cardinal. I only went when I had a problem or if I wanted to see about changing a course, something like that. I did not spend that much time with them. I did not have contact with professors in non-academic situations, except with the Cardinal. And it's the Cardinal Board relations there, or on committees that I might have served on, special kinds of meetings, things like that, or interviews with professors about things. The course grades were generally determined by your term papers, your quizzes, and final exams. I don't think they were determined mostly by class participation. I ended up with a B+ average, about a 2.5. And I know I didn't participate much in class because I was very shy at that point, being much, so much younger. I don't know what percentage of students in the class received the grades. And I don't know what the meaning of the grades were anymore. My mother and I considered grades important. I felt I had enough reputation to uphold. We always did well. I did not feel I had to be an A student or Phi Beta Kappa. That was not traditional in my family, but I did feel I had to do well. The final exams were always in the blue book. They were not. We had no open books or take-home exams. I seem to recall there was an exam break. We used to have a file of blue books in the sorority, I do remember, especially for things like KIFO for economic quiz. We used to have a quiz every week in Economics 1. And those were given primarily by graduate assistants, and they were marked by graduate assistants, who, as I recall, used to have a sort of a sheet that told them key words. And these were essay questions. We didn't have anything like one-word answer questions then. I think I had two courses that had one-word answer questions, sociology and math. They would have a list of keywords, and then you could write all you wanted and answer the question, but if you had those keywords someplace in your sentence, they marked it correct. Exams were generally proctored, usually by these graduate assistants. I don't remember much cribbing as a problem, and I don't remember whatever happened to people with crib notes. I do know that we used to read old exams and probably memorize some of the things from the old exams. Final grades, I think we used to get mailed to us. We used to give a postcard with our name on the back for each course, and that would be mailed to us. Number 40, I didn't take lab courses, so I don't know about equipment. 41, the professors who influenced me most. I think that one of them was Frederick Burkhardt in philosophy, because he said to me on a final exam, "You've given me back everything I said in class, so that's good. You learned how to memorize it, but that's not what I want. I want to know what you think. How do you feel? What do you feel about these things?" And it's the first time anyone had really clearly explained to me the whole thought process that education involved, that I was not supposed to just memorize, do things by rote, but I was supposed to be thinking. And that really awakened me completely there. I don't remember much else about him, his appearance. I know he left to become president of Bennington later. I had some contact with Harold Taylor because he was on the Cardinal Board. and he was a philosophy teacher. I don't remember much about him otherwise. I then later had contact with him because my sister went to Sarah Lawrence, where he was later president. He didn't really influence me, however. Selig Perlman, I think, influenced me because with his accent, which people used to like make fun of, he still was so intense and so deep into his subject. His intellect and his appearance was nothing. He was this short guy with a Jewish accent, Russian accent, but he really made things alive for us. Another one I remember is Elizabeth Brandeis, who also had a reputation for being very queer and oddly dressed, and looked like a witch or something, but who was very lively, and I enjoyed learning from her very, very much. Merle Curti was another professor who I think was an excellent teacher, who made the social history of America come alive. Martin Clotchy was somebody I did get to know because he was also the director of a summer Institute of World Affairs that I attended. And he was a very, very outstanding history teacher. His appearance was very elegant, he was young with white hair. His intellect was obvious, and I don't know about his research interests, but he certainly was an outstanding teacher who really was able to contribute to my learning. And I'm skipping questions 43 to 51 since I did not live in a dorm and I did not live through off campus, so I'm going to question 55. I discussed already why I chose. I'm afraid I started on the other side first, but the wrong pages going into the Cardinal and the sorority houses. So I, in effect, have already discussed, you'll find on side A, why I chose to live in a sorority house. And this, just to recap at this point in the right order, it was primarily because there were no really viable alternatives for an out-of-state woman other than private Jewish rooming houses. Or something like Ann Emory or Langdon Hall, which were not very desirable particularly. Here at least I had a group that was congenial. We ran our own house. We controlled our house pretty much. The kind of food we wanted, the people who worked there, our hours, our conditions of living. And so from that standpoint, it was a very independent sort of an atmosphere. I had a roommate the first year I lived in the Jewish rooming house, I had one roommate. The second year in the sorority house, I had one roommate who was a senior and I was a sophomore and didn't really have much in common. My last 2 years, I had a single room, which was much more desirable. We had a house mother who was a woman, in probably her late 50s, 60s. As I say, we in effect had hired her. She was very good in arranging our meals. She was a little stiff and cold, and we did not really turn to her for assistance. I think we had some problems with her, as I recall later on. I don't remember having to dress for dinner, other than what we just sweaters. We had to be neat. Tables were, I think, tables of, I don't know, 6 or 8 people. I think we sat wherever we wanted to. We had boys, students, as waiters. They earned their money that way. Manners were not stressed. It was sort of supposed to be pretty good. We did not offer a prayer. The food was fairly attractively displayed. It was pretty good food, considering. I don't recall at all what we discussed in dinner time conversation. Our house did have rules. They were made by us, and I don't remember what they were particularly. We had curfew, which I think was a university rule, something like 9:30 weekday nights, and I had an exemption from those because I was at the Cardinal, so I used to get home sometimes at 12, and I had a key to let me myself in. I think that was only my last part of my junior and senior when I was an editor. Maybe it was even earlier. I don't really remember. During the weekends, I believe it was 12:30. And as far as leisure time, we spent our free time reading. Sometimes we played bridge, went to the movies. I don't recall too many of the places we went to relax. We did go to the Memorial, the Union, to the Rathskeller. I was not one to hang around too much in any of the hangouts places. The Jewish students, on the whole, did not go to forget the place we used to serve the bratwursts. We went to the chocolate shop. We went to concerts and plays a lot on campus. We went to football games. We all had equal access to the Memorial Union, as far as I know, and any other buildings on campus. I don't remember any kind of problem with that at all. I don't re as far as number 67, fads and hobbies that were popular. I'm afraid I got a blank on that one. The books that everyone was reading, other than school books, I don't think we had much time for anything else. And I don't really remember what my leisure reading was. The movie idols of the day. Oh, I guess I. Looking back on the Cardinal, I can see certainly Walter Pigeon and Greer Garson, Humphrey Bogart, and Lauren Bacall was, I think, just about becoming famous at that point. Yeah, I don't really remember. I can't think of. My mind goes blank as far as unless I look at these ads in the paper. Lohmeyer's. I always look at Lohmeyer's. Cardinal's falling apart here. There wasn't much of a choice of movie theaters, as I can recall. And there was the Strand and the Capitol and the Orpheum, and a couple of others too. But there was Mickey Rooney was playing, and there was Pat O'Brien. But I don't really remember that much. Radio shows, we all listened to our Hit Parade. That was something I think everybody participated in. But I don't really remember anything else. My mind seems to be a blank about that. Because I'm more likely to think of radio shows from my childhood, and I can't really straighten out. It was mostly listening to news, to music, to songs, to bands, and I really can't think of any other kind, any radio things offhand that we might have listened to. We had plays every once. So of course, I think that one of the things that I liked most in leisure time was going to both plays that came from popular, I mean, famous people who came in plays on the road, in road shows, and at the Memorial Union. I was, having come from New York, where I always was an avid theater goer, I was at first quite snobbish about the Memorial Union, the student plays. And yet, when I began going to them, that was primarily because I used to get free tickets as the editor of the Cardinal. I was amazed at how outstanding it was. Of course, the marvelous theater that we had was excellent. And the productions that they gave were really outstanding. That they were very, very good. The Wisconsin Players, I mean. Now, in your questions of number 71, obviously, did you read the Cardinal? I'll be interested to see what other people said. The other campus publications, there was the Badger. A typical date was very different, obviously, during the war. A typical date before Pearl Harbor was not very typical for me, since, as I said, I was very young and only went to a few dances. They were mostly fraternity dances. One of the things that I think was very peculiar to Wisconsin, I don't know whether how long it went on, but it has almost always seemed amazing to me, is that the Daily Cardinal used to print date lists for sorority and fraternity, and even for especially dormitory dances. I think it was on, if it'd be on a Friday, you'd see, this is, here's the guest list of this sorority's dance, and there would be the names of all the people, and you'd sign up in your sorority, you'd sign up your name so you could see that nobody else had invited that person to go to be their date before you invited them. And everybody would look. That was the first thing they would open on Saturday or Sunday, whatever day it was, to look who had taken whom to what, to the dance the night before. And this, as I think of it, was really a horrible kind of system. A typical date was that a date would come pick you up. You'd either, if you went to a, you're going to a dance, you would go to a dance. Sometimes they were formal, sometimes they were informal. The formal ones were really not very common, but there were formal. I remember my freshman year going to several of them. Those formal dresses I had were worn pretty often. The beauty parlor was busy that day before. And the... or else you'd just go to a movie, and then maybe go to the chocolate shop afterwards. Or you might go to the Rathskeller, or go to a movie at the Union, go to a play. I was a very naive young woman who had no sort of sexual relations with anybody at that point, drank very little, started to smoke during the war of all times, crazy kinds of cigarettes we had that really didn't do it very much, knew nothing about drugs, and knew very little about sex. I was very shocked by a few of my colleagues who were very knowledgeable and very participating, although this was mostly a very small group. I had never had much discussion with my mother about social lives, college students, or any kind of question of politics. At number 75, I knew very little about intramural sports. I was not a participant in any kind of sport. As far as the major spectator sports, obviously football was the big one. I had never been to a football, having gone to an all-girls high school. I knew nothing about football, but that was the big thing our freshman year. We had season's tickets. We went to all the football games. Basketball was a much less popular sport. Very few of us ever went to the basketball games. Football was the one that Wisconsin was perceived as a national power. L. Roy Hirsch was there my freshman year. Big Ten was a big thing. And I had followed football to some extent, more limited extent, but certainly right after college for many years there. Pat Harder is another name I remember. I recall he was killed in the war, and the dormitory was named after him, I think. Those are the two names that I mostly remember. We rarely went to football games with dates. We just went in groups as a whole. Sometimes the sorority would have a donuts and cider party afterwards. And a number of us did show school spirit at sporting events, singing varsity, and things like that. The major social events of the year were probably the various sorority, and then of course our junior prom and the senior prom. I don't remember that much. I do remember that I imported a date, I think, for my senior prom. Somebody from New York who was in service in Missouri who came to the university to visit me there. But we had a real orchestra. I don't remember who it was anymore. I could look it up here. And as I was on the committee, I was working before on it beforehand, so I was sort of a participant in the thing. That was the big thing. We mostly were promoting it for the Cardinal. I did not have a part-time job while attending school. I did work a couple of times at a defense plant, just because I thought it was the thing to do, but it just took too much of my time. I had no participation in any religious life or activities at school. I was involved in student government, got down to number 94, only through service on various committees, Union News Bureau my freshman year and a couple of other committees other times. I kept out of student government when I became an active executive in the Cardinal, because it was the only way I felt I could be objective and criticize student government. I perceived the role of student government at the time of having some kind of effect on campus policies and procedures to the extent that the university would permit them. They did have control over a number of activities, and there was not very great participation of students in it. And I tried to encourage more students to take part through editorials. But since obviously the students who were not taking part were not reading the editorials, that didn't have much effect. But as I did mention on the other side, I note that 40% of the women did participate in the women's student government election in 44. So I think that did show a certain participation. There were radical political student groups even in the 40s on campus. I was not associated with them. We did have a number of columns by people. We opened our columns of the Cardinal to all the groups, and left, right, and they all wrote on them. I think it was good they had them there, especially during the war. As far as the miscellaneous campus concerns, the dean of men was Scott Goodnight, at least at the beginning. Dean of women was Louise Troxell. Their role was sort of to, in effect, be a sort of mother or father figure for students and sort of see that rules were established for their behavior, but also to help them. I really had very little to do with Scott Goodnight, other than reading about him. I can't remember the dean after him. But I was quite close with Dean Troxell, and indeed had worked with her even after I graduated, had had contacts with her. She, I think, was much more a more human sort of person who was vitally interested in the role of women and in promoting their role and in promoting their participation in campus activities and advising and counseling with them. And I think she was the one who introduced an assistant dean, Emily Chervenik, on the campus, who was sort of a guidance counselor, that's what we call them today, and who I also kept contact with after, for a number of years after I graduated. And I had a number of very good personal contact with both of them as alumni. I think they were really probably pioneers in what's today is very much accepted as the woman's role in a co-ed campus or any kind of a campus. They promoted participation, a recognition or perception of what women could do, and were very active participants of the campus. I had no other personal contact with any of the deans. Clarence Dykstra was president during most of the years that I attended school. I had some contact with him as when I'm editor of the Cardinal, and I believe E.B. Fred took over after that. But all I really remember is going to the president's house on Christmas and singing Christmas carols. I don't really remember that much of the president's. I've had no contact with the regents. I think we had good relations with the merchants and citizens of Madison during the war, they probably relied to us on a great extent for their existence, at least for the merchants. We did have ads from shoe stores and clothing stores, I see in the Cardinal, hair shops and restaurants and music records. The student body was, of course, a major participant in all that, making their business work. As far as the effect of the war of the 103 on my life as a student, I think I've gone into that a great extent on the other side. It certainly had a devastating effect on the one hand, and that I had a completely atypical type of experience in the classroom and on the campus. Everything changed, many things closed down. We had students in uniform. We kept hearing about students who were killed or wounded, and it was a very unreal situation in many ways, and only too real in other ways. On the other hand, I had many opportunities personally that I never would have had, obviously, if this university had continued as it was my freshman year. I still think I might have gotten a fairly high position on the Cardinal, maybe my experiences would have been even more valuable working under other people's supervision. But obviously it had a very great effect. And just as I was graduating, other students were coming back, a number of veterans were coming back. One veteran, John McNally, became the editor of the Cardinal after me. I had been favoring Jane Weisselberg, who had been one of my assistant editors. I felt that she had worked there in those 3 years and she deserved to become the editor. But of course, the idea of a veteran who had turned white in service coming back to campus is a very influential factor, I think. And I'm sure, I think he did an outstanding job. I believe he's still on the faculty at the university right now. My career goals when I graduated from Wisconsin were to become a journalist. And I did indeed go to the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism when I graduated. When I graduated from Columbia, I came back to Madison and went to Milwaukee and tried to get a job in the Milwaukee Journal, which I did not succeed in. I think my education prepared me for going into journalism. It gave me a boost, certainly. I learned an enormous amount, both through my education, but probably more so through my editorship of the Cardinal and the responsibilities that I had there. My education gave me a very good background academically, stimulated my thinking, made me better able to make judgments about things, to learn how to learn about things. It opened up new vistas, new channels, all kinds of experiences, the kinds of people that I met from all over, but particularly those from Wisconsin, I would say, who were very open, very friendly, very warm to someone with a completely different background. I did go on from Columbia School of Journalism to work on a daily newspaper in Massachusetts, in New Bedford, Massachusetts, but then decided I wanted to go back to New York and left the daily newspaper field. Well, actually, I went to work for the New York Times, but the New York Times Youth Forums, and then later went to live in Paris for about a year and a half, came back to do a variety of public relations assignments, and then became editor of a weekly welfare and health newspaper. And then when I moved to Washington, moved into a firm doing writing and public relations, primarily in the health and education field. And I'm now president of a company, a woman-owned company, which is called Information Services Incorporated, which specializes in all forms of communication, primarily the written word, as editorial services and public relations activities. I think that the quality and scope of the education I received at Wisconsin were excellent. I think that the kind of education people are getting today is probably much broader, much more far-seeing in terms of encouraging individual thinking and research and writing. I'm getting more of a personal, well, at least in the smaller school. I have a son who just graduated from Columbia and a daughter who is now a student at Sarah Lawrence. And I think that she in particular is getting a much more exciting and challenging kind of an education. But I don't think you can compare it because the era is so different today. For the time that I went to Wisconsin, I think the quality of my education was outstanding. The scope, of course, was dependent on the subjects that I chose. There were people there who spent their days playing bridge in between class, and I don't think they really got anything as much out of their education. But I think that my work with the Cardinal was probably the most exciting, the most unique, and the most valuable that anybody could ever have asked for. To answer Barry Teicher's questions, your first question concerns the Daily Cardinal and my early involvement. My early interest in the Daily Cardinal started because I wanted to be a newspaper reporter. I had been the managing editor of my high school paper, and the first thing I thought of when I came to Madison was to go down and work on the Cardinal. And I did. My freshman year, I was an eager, avid reporter, working under the tutelage, particularly of Dick Leonard, who was then the managing editor, and who today, I believe, is still the editor of the Milwaukee Journal. Bob Lewis was the executive editor at that point. They were wonderful teachers. They taught us so much all about putting out a newspaper, at a daily paper. It was very hectic. It came out 6 days a week, I think, as I recall. I don't have any copies going that far back. That was the year that the Cardinal celebrated its 50th anniversary, put out a special issue. And, of course, that was the year of Pearl Harbor. And by the time summer came around, it was obvious that there weren't going to be many men left on the campus. As time went on, it became difficult to get any kinds of ads. The usual ads had been cigarette ads. And there was decreased enrollment. It was very difficult to have any money to continue to put out the paper. And after much arguing, it was finally decided that we should take some money, contributions from the university, to pay for a sort of a calendar of university events. We also had, as I recall, military columns. I think there was a Badger Navy News, I think an ASTP page. And we got paid for these things, which enabled us to continue publishing during the war years. Although we did have some minor advertising, primarily from local institutions, local publications. A lot of them were just house ads. A lot of it, we used to run a lot of canned boilerplate on the government, something called American Heroes from the Treasury Department to get people to buy bonds, and all little kinds of little fillers that would fill in. I don't think my status as a woman from out of state or being Jewish affected my relationships with anybody else in the Cardinal. The Cardinal had always had a reputation for being quite liberal, and many of the people who came from New York were known as being liberal, if not indeed radical. One of the people I worked with very closely that first year was another freshman named Jack Geiger, who was quite left-wing, a very eager, avid, marvelous writer, who during the summer, that following summer, as I recall, was the editor of the Cardinal, and because he became, it was a little bit too to the left, was in effect eased out. And I well recall having meetings in Greenwich Village that summer, I think after the summer session was over, trying to decide what to do when we went back to school. Jack Geiger's role was played for him when, I think, as I recall, he entered the Navy. And he today happens to be a very prominent community-minded medical doctor. Others who were on the Cardinal with me and who did stick it out during the rest of the time, who didn't get drafted, were Jane Marilyn Johnson, who later became managing editor when I was the editor, and Jane Weisselberg, and Ruth Jager and Pat Hogue, who were actually the first two women to become editors of the Cardinal. Ruth Jager just for a semester. Pat Hogue took over after her at the beginning of 1944 when Ruth Jager graduated. She had married, her name was Pat Hogue Larson. She had appendicitis and was quite ill after that, and finally had to resign from the Cardinal, which to her sadness. It was at that time that I was appointed, and I took over officially as of, looking back at my old issues, on February 16th, 1944. The actual way the Cardinal was organized at that point was that there was a student elected, an elected board of control, which had, as I recall, seven students on it. It also had three faculty members. The editor was sort of an ex officio member of the board. And they, as far as I know, they I don't know just how much control, I don't really remember at this point just how much control they did have. They were the ones actually who appointed the executives
of the cardinal. And I do know that when the end of my term ended, and because I had taken over in February, and then in April I continued started a full term. I actually was editor probably longer than anybody else was, because I continued to the following April of 45. And the editorial policy was really decided by the editor. I could write any kinds of editorials pretty much that I wanted to. When I look back now, they probably seem rather childish. A lot of it was trying to get people to buy war stamps, trying to say something to get them to do their part for the war. Some of them were just strictly on collecting scrap or participating in any kinds of war drives. Some of them, of course, were on various kinds of campus committees, on elections, on participation in getting things done. To some extent, we did write on the future. What was the future world going to be like? We wrote columns on what the war memorial should be. That was a big project, I remember. We had an idea for an international house, some kind of building that would affect the whole campus, that would promote better international relations, international understanding. This was something that was one of my pet projects at the time. I wrote most of the editorials, and Letter Jane Weisselberg, who was one of my assistants. We also had guest writers. We also had columns. I wrote a column called A Medley of Extemporanea, taken from poem by Dorothy Parker. And we had other people who wrote columns. We invited various organization leaders to write columns. One of the things I should point out is during the war, the paper only came out 4 days a week. We were, I think, the last of the Big Ten universities to have to finally reduce it to 4 days a week. We lost a lot of our linotypists because of they went to war, and we couldn't set type sometime. I remember once we had a change, we couldn't get the paper ready until noon instead of early in the morning. It used to be that you'd read the Daily Cardinal with your breakfast. And we then published from Tuesday through Friday. We had to change that. We were actually the only morning newspaper in Madison at that point. And we knew that people liked to get their papers at breakfast before they went to their early classes. But obviously there was nothing we could do about that. We used to write editorials also a lot about student board, the lack of activities, or trying to encourage them to do more activities. We sometimes had groups, but there were some overlays. The Wisconsin Liberals Association, I remember when they voted to affiliate with the AYD, the American Youth for Democracy, and we had problems there about whether it was a communist organization. What should be done about that? We really did have the ultimate responsibility for editorial content. We never had any, I don't recall any actual fights or any certain, certainly we never had anybody taking over the paper and refusing to let it be published because of anything we had written. Maybe we just weren't quite that radical. The time when Jack Geiger had the problem was during the summer, when it was not a regular cardinal, it was actually a summer, an institution, a publication of the university itself. So I can't really say there was that kind of any kind of censorship of that kind. However, as I remember, the staff, the top executives were selected by the Cardinal Board. Anybody below, that was the top, the editor, managing editor, I think probably the sports editor, those under the top editor, anything, it was really the recommendation of the editor, and I think the board pretty much went along with it. So I was the managing editor at the time. I guess I was competing with Pat Hoag Larson when she was elected editor. She won out. I was managing editor, but then I ended up getting it anyway. There was not any controversy at all, as I can recall. I think it was everybody just assumed it was natural that I was going to serve as editor. I don't think there was any help or hindrance, my being a woman, am I being from out of state? Am I being Jewish? There was just no concern of that whatsoever. I don't think, as far as being a woman, the whole staff was practically, there was a sports editor, there were one or two other very, very few males on the staff at all. And as far as being out of state, there was no real reaction about that. I don't remember any kind of comment about that kind of thing. Actually, I was a candidate with the president of the student board, the president of the women's student government, the editor, the head of the Cardinal board, and the editor and the managing editor of the Cardinal. Those were the six of us who were candidates for the Alumni Association's annual award for the student who had done the most to promote the best interests of the university. And that was after I had actually completed my term as editor. So it must have been in about April or May. When I was interviewed, I remember being asked among the questions, it was a group interview, why I had come to University of Wisconsin and so on. But that was the only particular question that I recall being asked about that specific thing. Much to my amazement, I was selected as the winner of that award. And to this day, I'm still quite amazed and wondering if it was possibly a sort of a bending over backwards kind of thing. I really don't know. It was very unusual and very unexpected for me to have won that, but it certainly, it certainly seemed to indicate that there was no hindrance in being out of state or being Jewish or being a woman. The major issues that we dealt with that did generate controversy were primarily not war-related. They were primarily the ones about whether some liberal groups were, whether some groups were too much to the left, and even there was, I think, a misperception of what some of the groups were trying to do. They were really not overly that much to the left, frankly, as I look back on it now. We tried, I think, our best to, in the war period, to encourage the students to not look on it as being just part of the school as usual. Of course, it was obvious it wasn't, since we had so many military on campus. I recall very clearly a column that I wrote in which I really felt very deeply the problem of who were we to be actually here. We were sitting there and enjoying life on the campus and didn't really know what was going on abroad and what the there's a lot of the I can't remember quite the I did try to have a number of columns on post-war planning. This was part of my own interest in international relations, where I see, looking over my issues, that I did have a column on what kind of a world do we want after the war, and that we should be doing some kind of post-war planning at that point, pointing out that other schools have post-war planning committees and that we should have various kinds of things, what we're going to do for the returning and veterans, about special revisions of curriculum to include more courses in international relations, problems of peace, construction of new buildings, all kinds of plans of that. And that was something that we did try to cover a great deal. We also tried to promote student participation in government. I guess looking back, there must have been a separate election for the Women's Self-Government Association. So the women's lib hadn't gotten active then. And we did a lot, big, both news coverage and editorials encouraging women to get out and vote. And we seemed to have been fairly effective. I see we had 40% of the women did actually vote in the election, so I think we were pretty successful there. In looking back, I'm interested to see how many columns, guest columns there were by people with differing viewpoints on how to win the war, winning the war, how to win the peace, opposing the State Department, opposing the lack of negotiations for peace, columns on the on student opinion, columns on the Tehran Declaration. There were a number of discussions of that type, and the news stories, while there were an awful lot of the social types of stories, the social society, the sorority socials and things like that, still there were a number of news things, of coverage, of lectures, of various kinds of social events, of concerts going on, stories about the Women's Army Corps, about the Navy, about the different kinds of things that were happening. And there was a broad coverage promoting the war agencies, the Red Cross, the World Student Fund, things like that. So there were a lot of good general, broader coverage in the paper. I don't really know at this point just how the Cardinal was perceived in general. I think everybody felt it was something they had to read. I think it certainly was fairly well read, maybe not necessarily word for word, maybe not all the things that I would have liked them to read, but certainly it was perceived as a campus vehicle for expression of opinion and for the news. It was the only thing that people really did read on campus. Very few people ever saw the Cap Times or the State Journal. And as I recall, it was not, it came as part of your student fee, I think. I don't, it said 5 cents a copy, I see on it, but I think it was part of the student fee. I think, at least I know in the beginning it was. I see, it says here subscription rates were $4 per college year, and it was in a carrier, so I don't really remember. I think it was, I don't think individuals had to pay for subscriptions. If not, there were certainly plenty of copies around for people to get their own copies. And the faculty was very supportive. The university administration was certainly supportive, and they had this calendar item that they did, and they printed in the that we, and that they paid for us to help us pay for the costs. The regents, well, I guess we didn't really do anything that was quite as bad as has been done in other years of the Cardinal. There certainly have been times, of course, where the regents has gotten in the act and has opposed the Cardinal. That was not any time during my time. The alumni, again, we never had any actual contact with them. I do know certainly the Cardinal itself. I can must say that over the years, when I mentioned to somebody that I had been the editor of the Cardinal, it's always a very impressive. People are always very impressed by it, and anybody who has had anything to do with the university always knew what the Cardinal was, including many people who did not have anything to do directly. The Cardinal's reputation. It was an award-winning paper, and it was certainly a very vital kind of paper. I think it had a very high reputation all the way, all along. I just note that in February, when I took over as the editor, I wrote in a column that we were saying the position of the Cardinal as the student-owned and controlled newspaper of the university. And I think this was a very important matter. This was the thing we had fought from the beginning, that we would not accept any kind of control by the university, and that we sought to supply information, entertainment, and interpretation of events. Many of us were working maybe 25 hours a week. Most people did not get pay. When I was editor, I got $25 a month, as I recall. I really just went to pay, taking a taxi home late at night, something like that. I wrote at that point, it's difficult in these times without daring and ambitious men to run after the news and with an almost female staff. I don't know if I would say that today, but I guess that was the way we looked at it at that point. We said we hope the Cardinal will always remain a self-supporting student newspaper, and we were abiding by the obvious ethics of journalism. We asked for their support and cooperation, and I guess we got it along the way. I think that there was a good feeling of support with the Cardinal. On Alpha Epsilon Phi, I don't feel quite as positive. AE Phi, I'm looking back in my old badgers, I learned that Alpha Epsilon Phi was founded at Barnard College in 1909. It was established at Wisconsin in 1921. And the I don't know who the people were who founded it at that point. I don't know of any documents or anything that would detail its history, except where its archives might have been. I believe the headquarters, when I was in it, were someplace in the south. I can't remember exactly where. I just know that Dinah Shore was one of our most famous alumna. I understand that the sorority is now defunct. The building at 10 Langdon Street is no longer there. When I don't really know who could help you as far as the history of AE5, because I don't know anybody who really would know. And I never have kept up with any of my sorority sisters. I went to Wisconsin in September 1941. I was just 17 years old, and I was very immature. I'd gone to an all-girls high school, elementary school, public. I went there because my sister had just graduated. I went there because I was not accepted at Michigan, which was my first choice. So I went to Wisconsin. My sister had just graduated from Wisconsin. My sister had been an AE5, and of course when I went there, I was her sister. And it was just taken as a given that I would join. One of the odd housing situations at Wisconsin in 1941 was that the Elizabeth Waters had just opened, and it was limited to residents of the state of Wisconsin. There were also several private dormitories on Langdon Street, Ann Emery and Langdon Hall. Those were filled when we got there. As a result, there was a limited accommodation for women, especially for out of the state, especially Jewish women. And there were a number from New York, and there were a number from Chicago, and a couple of other large cities, Cleveland, Detroit, something like that. As a result, a group of private rooming houses had developed, most of which were Jewish. I remember one was called Georgian Hall. I can't even remember the name of the one that I lived in, but there were maybe 30, 35 women who lived there. And it was almost, for some people, it was almost an escape from this kind of living to join the sorority. The sorority was, in effect, a way of running yourself, running your own living arrangements. We, in effect, owned the building. We, in effect, selected our house mother, who really ran the house, but it was really under our rules, our regulations. When, in wartime, when we had rationing, our house mother, Mrs. Real, was fantastic at being able to use all our coupons combined to get us good meat and very excellent food, so that our food was really not at all like the kind of dormitory food it was. There was one other Jewish sorority, Phi Sigma Sigma, which had a sort of lower ranking socially status. As far as I know, not one other sorority on campus ever accepted a Jewish girl. There were similarly five Jewish fraternities. And of course, the dating went on primarily with those groups. My experiences during Rush were really very atypical because, as I said, my sister had been there before, and it was accepted that I was going to be pledged. There was no hazing. It was an initiation ceremony, sort of a lot of claptrap down in a secret sort of room in the basement where nobody else was allowed to go, which was sort of silly. I don't remember anything else about that. We had to go to the sorority house every Sunday for Sunday dinner. In fact, it was during one of those Sunday dinners that Professor Selig Perlman was our guest of honor, and he received a phone call during that dinner from his son to inform him that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. AE5 interacted with other sororities on campus and participated in the inter-sorority Panhellenic group. Their members socialized with members primarily of the Jewish fraternities. I don't know any of them went out with anybody in the Jewish fraternity. They did go out with non-fraternities. It was a very socially, we had friends in other sororities, the non-Jewish sororities, but there was no real dating and no really close friendship with the others. The members of AE5 were very active on campus. They held some very top positions. One was even, one or two of them, I remember, were even junior prom queens. I was on various committees. I was one of the committee chairmen from a junior prom when I was a junior. One of our members, Ruth Welling, was in mortarboard the year before me, and then I was elected to mortarboard. Interestingly enough, the only people I still keep in contact with from Wisconsin are other members, group of other members of my mortarboard chapter, none of whom are Jewish, and most of whom are from Wisconsin. The sorority itself did encourage the members to get good grades, to participate in campus activities. The sorority as a whole, I don't recall it's actually doing anything much in the way of any kind of group activity. Membership in AE5 did not really affect my social standing, except that maybe that helped me meet some, boy, I was very shy and quite immature, especially my freshman year. And it might have just brought a couple little bit more of dates than I might have gotten otherwise. But I can't say that there were any real benefits that I obtained from belonging to AE5, other than it gave me a sense of belonging, being so far away from home. I never really was there very much. I had my own key to the house because I was always down with the Cardinal. I did become the scribe or secretary. I think I sort of gave me that as a, because I was a writer and therefore I could send little notices to the National Journal about what we were doing. Today, it's of course very smart and very clever to scorn and be very scornful of sororities. And of course, I am when I'm thinking of it in today's settings and with our perceptions of today. At the time, it was probably important to me, even though I didn't participate that much. When I look back on it now, I see that many of my sorority sisters were snobs, but others of them were very warm, friendly people who were very helpful, very, very proud of my accomplishments, and very supportive of everything that I ever wanted to do. However, I must say that I think there's no place for sororities in American life today. I, at this point, want to go back to something I was discussing before. I hadn't found it before when I was talking about the Cardinal. One thing that I was kind of proud of in looking back was that I did have some sort of realization, even though I was, what, 19 years old then, 1920, of some of the things that we were trying to achieve in a war. I wrote a column, and I just found it, January 12th, in which I said, what have we to say, we who sit back comfortably and securely and read about people shooting and dying, and all we've done here, we're sitting here buying war stamps and writing morale-building letters, helping in the hospitals, thinking and planning and making their peace, and we're going, you know, through it all, and we're sitting about what we're going to do for the future, and we're having lots of fun about it, but what about their future, and what are we going to be losing faith with them, and what is the spirit that we are thinking about? And I asked if we could, we'll ever be able to forget our petty antagonisms, our foolish quarrels, our discriminations and our hatreds, our dogmatic beliefs and our backward moves of reaction. And said, is there, can we overcome the sluggishness, the dirt, the fear, the hatred, and do something, that we were the leaders of the tomorrow? It was a very idealistic kind of a thing, but looking back, I can see that I was really trying to say that we had all these great aims and these wonderful words we were using in the war. Were we going to really go forward with something, or are we going to fall right back into isolationism and selfishness and disregard? And I closed by saying, can we fail our own future? And I later used that as a theme for trying to get a war memorial and trying to get things going, to do something that we would have some sort of a fitting remembrance of what went on. And several weeks later, and I found it out again, I got a letter from somebody who had been sent some old cardinals by an aunt, and said that he couldn't believe that this was somebody back in school, that a woman, a girl, a college student, a civilian, was capable of grasping these attitudes, because these were the same questions that men in the front lines had been asking themselves. He said, there was scarcely a man whose thoughts are not in accord with those you have voiced in your article. And he asked a friend to read it, and he was just as amazed to think that I could have grasped the attitudes of men living in such a different world. And they said they had discussed the article, they let others read it. And he said, you see, Miss Martinson, until we read your appeal to your fellow students, we believed that no one back there, except those who had once gone through this hell called war, could grasp the picture of our thoughts and hopes of the hours to which we shall return. Through your writing, we again have some assurance of the possibility of the existence of the kind of post-war world all of us desire. It is for this assurance we wish to thank you, for showing us that back there in the, quote, promised land, there are people who understand our wants and expectations, and people who are working for us, preparing for our eventual homecoming and return to civilization. Yours for a great future. We know you cannot fail us. Can you doubt that that really made my day?